It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's changing your house, creating spaces for entertaining. No, we're not talking a remodel. We're talking working with what you've got. Maverick architect Sarah Susanka has tricks for making your guests feel great. It's all in light and shadow. Her book is Home by Design, Transferring Your House into Home. Well, the Stearns have found a hole-in-the-wall place for dynamite Cuban sandwiches in the middle of Times Square. Steve Jenkins, the cheese-obsessed, says forget the girls of summer, go for the cheeses. We get the skinny on the ultimate gazpacho from Spain-obsessed Anya von Bremsen, and we hear what estate coffees are really all about. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today, an architect talks the tricks to creating entertaining spaces with what you've got. Our guest, Sarah Sue Sanka, made a stir with her first book, The Not-So-Big House. Her latest volume looks at how we actually live in our spaces. It is Home by Design, Transforming Your House into Home. Right now, in pastures across America, happy beasts are munching on luscious grass. This is the time of the pure gold milk. Our cheese guy, Steve Jenkins, talks the best cheeses of summer. And we have the ultimate gazpacho, the backstory on estate coffees, and a new way to eat out with your kids. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. So Jane, Michael, you've been in the big city. What have you found?
Well, we found an amazing little place. Amazing because it is virtually in Times Square. And unlike many things there, this has not been Disney-fied. This is a real hole-in-the-wall Cuban restaurant with a full Cuban menu. You cannot spend more than $10 for a meal there. And one of the specialties is one of the best Cuban sandwiches I've ever eaten. Have a listen.
Start from the beginning. Tell me, a Cuban sandwich is?
Cuban sandwich is a hero. Cuban bread with garlic sauce, Swiss cheese, salami, pork, and ham. And it's toasted, and it's very hot. And we also put some mustard, if you like, pickles, and hot sauce.
Is that very popular here?
Yes, it is.
What else do you have here?
We also have the octopus salad, octopus and oxtails, fried chicken, pork chop. And we also have the steak sandwich, pernil sandwich, and the best is the octopus and the Cuban sandwich.
Michael, what's it? Michael, a pernil sandwich?
I didn't know what that was either, and in fact, the last time Jane and I went there, that's what I ordered. It turns out to be roast pork, but to say simply roast pork doesn't begin to describe how deeply flavored this pork is. I think it's one of those roasts that cooks for a day.
And fork tender.
I mean, tenderer than fork tender. It falls
apart.
In fact,
they because it's such an informal place, they give you plastic knife and fork. And when I sat there with this pork in front of me, I thought, oh my God, how am I going to cut this? Well, using just the edge of the plastic fork, it just fell apart. It was like the best pot roast you ever had.
Now, is this a Cuban family that does this restaurant?
It was started by three Cuban guys. In fact, the name Margon is a contraction of their three last names. It's now, oddly enough, run by a bunch of Dominicans. So it's Cuban-Dominican. The food is primarily Cuban food, traditional Cuban food, with specials every day, including, we usually go in on Thursday. The specials on Thursday are tripe and pig's feet, pot roast, and oxtail.
Now, Lynn, I won't have any part of that, so you know what I have, which is my favorite
thing. That a girl, Jane?
My favorite thing in the world is I have a mango milkshake, and I have a plate of black beans, yellow rice, and fried sweet plantains. Heaven, 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 heaven. And then the best espresso and
yes.
flan for dessert.
I have to say, Dr. Atkins is flipping in his grave as he hears this.
Oh, but it is carbo heaven. Do you know what else is great about this place? Make sure you ask for Lupe when
yes.
you go there, because she's one
she's the one who told us about
the counter ladies. And the people who run Margon, I mean, you truly will forget you're in Midtown Manhattan. They are so sweet and so concerned. I think I left half a plantain on my plate, and you know they wanted to wrap it in this huge box for me to take home. I mean, they are just the most darling people.
How did you find this place? Because I'm thinking Times Square is now just jammed with, you know, chains and
whatever.
Well, I actually have to credit our editor at Gourmet, James Rodewald, who we told him we were coming into the city. Was there a place that we could eat that wasn't one of these swank, fancy restaurants that we usually go to?
Gourmet has its offices at 4 Times Square, so we're right down there.
He said, I know just the place. You guys will love it. And he took us to Margon, and sure enough, this is our kind of place in the heart of Manhattan. And in fact, the place itself, we've got to tell you, is really charming. It is one of those really impossibly narrow New York restaurants where the counter is on the left. You order there. There are some tables on the right. And between those two is maybe a 2.5-foot aisle where you walk down the center of the place.
They actually have the weirdest counter stools. These are stools you sit at. There are literally no place for your legs. I mean, if you sit on the counter stool,
so you mean
to
you're so close,
like a frog with your legs completely splayed out.
But the counter stool is a good place to be because you're right opposite the espresso machines. And as Jane was saying, this place has what I consider the best cup of espresso I have had this side of Miami or Rome. It is so good. I don't know why it's so good, but it is just, it's foamy, it's incredibly rich, not the least bit bitter, and you get bigger than one of those I cups, you know, like a, you get like a double or triple shot. It makes all other espressos pale by comparison.
Oh, this is, guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
You're welcome, Lynn.
I'm thinking about a Cuban sandwich. He threw a nickel to the corner boy for watching his car. He drove down to the castle of the Jaguar.
Yeah,
the waitress leaned over. He could see her powder red bra. He said, baby, what? Give me a Cuban sandwich.
What's it like?
It's got two kinds of pig, ham and roast pork, a slice of white cheese as long as you're full. Yeah, throw in a pickle. Woo. If you're ever in New York, say El Cubano. That's a Cuban sandwich.
The Stearns are authors of The Indispensable Guide, Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, sign up for our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. It's brought to you by the farmers at Organic Valley. Each week, we send you a new recipe for a fast supper dish. This week, it's Vietnamese chicken and rice noodle salad. I mean, talk about cool. And then you get technique tips and shopping tips, but best of all, the newsletter is free. So sign up at that place where all life's little problems are solved, splendidtable.org. Steve Jenkins has spent the last quarter century hunting down great artisan cheeses on both sides of the Atlantic. He sells his finds at the Fairway Markets in New York City and is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Hey, Steve, it is good to have you back.
Oh, I'm so proud to be with you again, Lynn.
I want to talk about the seasons of cheese. Specifically, it's summer. What's in prime state right now?
That's such a good question. Well, first of all, you got to understand that in the summertime, goats and cows and sheep are feeding on fresh forage, fresh herbage, and it's has a tremendous effect on the milk that they deliver as regards the profusion of different wild flowers and wild onions and wild garlic and leaves off of trees and things. And the resulting effect is that the chlorophyll that they ingest finds its way through the mammal lactation into the milk, and the result is really sweet and rich cheese, much richer than any of the other three seasons, even more so than at the end of summer when the pastures are their lushest.
Uh-huh.
It's the chlorophyll that makes the cheese taste so good.
So is this the time of year to eat, like, fresh cheeses? Because they, you know, you get all of the impact of that richness and the freshness of all of that grass?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm often dismissive of fresh cheeses because they don't have enough character for me. But so many people like young, sort of mild cheeses, it just makes a lot of sense. But more important, Lynn, is that 3 months ago was the first growth of grass, which is the most prized and most wonderful time of year for cheesemakers and for animals in terms of their happiness and their ebullience and the way their systems work to deliver milk. But what's so cool about this time of year, middle to late July, is that the cheeses that were made 3 months ago with the first growth of grass are now 3 months old. So that means the great Tome de Savoie, the great Morbiers, the superb Spanish cheeses that aren't aged that long, like Mahon. All those cheeses that are available right now were made from the best milk of the whole year. So it's not just fresh cheeses, it's also the aged cheeses that we get that are 2, 3, 4 months of age.
Okay, so you named a few of them, but I would love some names of both fresh and
started.
Some...
Oh, my goodness.
Go for it, boy. Go for it.
I'm telling you that so many cheese shops now have access to burrata, B-U-R-R-A-T-A, which is the classic mozzarella concoction that comes from Campania, the area east of Naples and the hills behind Sorrento. Burrata is this amorphous glob of mozzarella that's wrapped around shreds and full cream, which when you just sort of lop it into six hunks on a plate, just dissolves, just unfolds itself onto the plate in this gorgeous, gloppy mess that you just eat with your hands or with a fork. You know, you're going to grate some fresh black peppercorns over it and drizzle it with some olive oil and serve it with some really good tomatoes and onions. But that's one of the most absolute drop-dead knockout things I've ever put in my mouth. Burrata.
What else? What else?
I think it'd be so neat to understand how great a serious aioli can be in the summertime. An aioli is not just a sauce that's made with olive oil and garlic.
Right, it's like a mayonnaise.
It's an egg yolk. It's also a whole dish. It's a whole meal to have your favorite people around with a aioli right in the center of the table. A big crock of great, fresh, handmade aioli surrounded by vegetables that are either steamed or are raw in the summertime. Of course, best time for vegetables. What you're doing is just poking vegetables into that aioli sauce and having a big bowl of shards of bread on the table and serve it with chèvre. Serve it with a great summertime chèvre. I don't care if it's fresh. I prefer it be middle-aged so it's got some toothsomeness to it and some real nuttiness to it. But to serve a chèvre, a perfect goat's milk cheese with a classic aioli, is one of the most fun and delicious things in the whole world.
Garlic mayonnaise, fresh vegetables, and a chèvre cheese, a goat cheese. It sounds pretty good.
Oh, Lynn, and also the sheep's milk cheeses in the summertime are just a knockout. The Corsican sheep milk cheeses that you and I have talked about in the past, like Brendamore, also called Fleur de Maquis, that perfect square pillow that's covered with herbs from the island off the south coast of France. The Vanacco from Corsica, the Fiumorbu from Corsica, the Golo from Corsica. These are just drop-dead sheep's milk cheeses, or Tuscan sheep's milk cheeses this time of year. Particularly good. Gives you more excuse to serve a big bowl of olives that you've washed and dressed, and you've got some really good crusty bread. So sheep cheeses are something I want our listeners to pay attention to in the marketplace. Also great time for stone fruit. Just to cut up a bunch of plums and peaches, put them in a big bowl, and serve it with great goat's milk cheese. There's just nothing better in the summertime. Oh, you know something else I found out a few nights ago?
Yeah?
Margaritas go great with goat's milk cheese. Oh, man.
Well,
don't even think about chilling a bottle of wine. Just make a pitcher load of good margaritas and use real Cointreau and use real agave tequila and make sure it's as cold as ice and serve them with some chèvres. Heaven.
Steve, incredible. Hey, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. Well, Stephen hangs out behind the cheese counters at Fairway Markets in New York City, but his summer cheese picks are on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, a maverick architect talks entertaining and the ultimate gazpacho. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. When you have people in, do you feel like your home is fighting you at every step? That it's just not the place to have company? Well, this is the kind of thing that architect Sarah Susanka thinks about all the time. I see Sarah as a maverick architect. Her first book, The Not-So-Big House, introduced the idea that many square feet doth not a better home make. In her latest book, Homes by Design, she examines how design can create that elusive sense of welcome. Sarah, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Sarah, I'd like to focus on gatherings, you know, bringing together families and friends, eating together. The things that we can do with the space we live in that doesn't involve building, because most of us are kind of stuck with what we've got.
Right.
The key to me is there a way to design a space or rearrange a space that makes people walk into it and want to kind of kick off their shoes and relax?
Well, there certainly is. I think perhaps the most important thing is being able to see one place from another. So, for example, if you as the cook are talking with people, you don't want them to be so separate that you've got to shout or you've got to look under a set of cabinets and duck in order to be able to talk to them. So making sure that the place that your guests are going to sit perhaps while you're preparing food is close enough that they can see you, there's a comfortable discussion distance established. Frequently in houses, you'll find that the sitting space is too far away, so people will actually grab their chairs and come and sit closer to you just so that they can be in the area that you're preparing the food.
So is this a case, when you say kind of furniture and arrangement, mm-hmm. do you mean things that are easily portable? So that's not the big armchair, but it's the chair I can easily pull up, you know, and sit closer kind of thing?
Well, either one will work. But if it's the comfortable armchair, it again needs to be close enough that they're not talking over 20 feet. They're, you know, maybe 10 to 15 feet at max from where you are. I had an interesting experience a few years ago where I was in somebody's house and they had family over and they actually all picked up the dining room chairs and brought them right over to where the kitchen island was so that they weren't so far away from the cook as they talked. And I realized they could do that because they were family, but most people wouldn't have done that. But it just indicated how when we're social, we like to be fairly close together. I think that's why the kitchen island is often such a wonderful congregating place for people, because they can be that participant without being right in the middle of the kitchen.
What about things like lighting? Can that create the mood that makes you want to come around the table or come into a space?
Well, absolutely. Lighting is incredibly important. In fact, one of the things that I was thinking when you were mentioning gathering places is that you can actually steer people where you want them to go based on the lighting. So, for example, if you've been preparing food in the kitchen, the light is probably brightest in the kitchen. But if you want to then get people over to the dining table, if you can lower the light in the kitchen, maybe just leave the under cabinet lights on, something like that,
right,
and then turn the light over the table so that it becomes the focal point. It becomes a pool of light that you want to gravitate towards. It's so simple when you understand how we're wired.
Is there a way to design a space that would draw children into it? Because, you know, I'm thinking about getting kids around the dinner table, getting mm-hmm. kids and parents together. Can you design right. a space that makes it work for both ends of the family?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I always tell people, if you want to find out the most interesting space in your house, let a couple of five-year-olds free for a few minutes and they will gravitate to the most interesting spot. But I would say probably for children, if you could create an alcove or a place that might have a smaller table within the same space that's their little spot, my guess is they would love that.
So you could even tuck them between bookshelves and stuff.
Yes, absolutely. Children, you know, they'll gravitate to those little places that give them a sense of the space having been designed the right scale for them. So I would say that would be a wonderful solution. I've never done one like that, but it's a great idea.
All right, now I've got a challenge. I'm a renter. I have a studio apartment. It's one room. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I love to have people over, but it's like, you know, they're in the middle of my bedroom.
They're writing everything.
Yeah. And yes. How do I make that space function for entertaining if I want to have a big group and have the room not feel like they're being squeezed in, or if I want to have a little intimate, you know, kind of supper?
Sure, sure. Well, there's a number of things I've done in the past with situations like that. Perhaps my favorite solution is if you want to give the apartment some division, but not something that's there all the time, you can either use one of those trifold screens. They look like shoji screens.
Right.
Or you can also actually hang a Venetian blind from the ceiling partway through the space. And when the Venetian blind is down, you then have two separate rooms, essentially. Not acoustically separate, but visually separate.
Right, right.
You can open the Venetian blind and be able to see partly through it. This is what I call an implied wall. But in this case, it's an implied wall that can disappear entirely, except when you have guests.
All right, now I'm going to have a big party. And the apartment isn't very big. My studio isn't very big. How do I make it feel like the walls aren't going to close in? Yeah.
Well, is this a nighttime party?
It's a nighttime party.
Okay. I would suggest, you know, we talked about the idea of a pool of light over the dining table. If you make two or three different places in addition to the dining table area that have that kind of pool of light to them, again, they'll attract small groups of people. So perhaps you have a table lamp and a couple of chairs around it, and you make use of the corners, because people will tend to gravitate to those more sheltered places. And that way, your eye reads the pools of light as individual spots to go congregate, and it actually assumes there's more space there than there actually is. If you make everything all the same light level and all bright, it probably won't work as well.
So you want the room to be softly lit, and then you have these pools of light and thin corners because we like to be protected.
You've got it, exactly.
Hey, thank you, Sarah.
Oh, you're really welcome. It was great to be here.
Architect Sarah Susanka is author of Home by Design, Transforming Your House into Home. Now, you'll find more information on the website, splendidtable.org. Anya von Bremsen is a food journalist. Her beat is the world, but one of her favorite places is Spain. Anya has been tracking the entire spectrum of Spanish food, from the great traditions to the great modern upheavals started by New Line Spanish chefs. Now, Anya's latest book is The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Anya, welcome.
Great to be here.
You know, Anya, we've talked about paella, one of the great Spanish dishes, but there's another dish we all identify with Spain, gazpacho. How does gazpacho play in Spain?
Well, it's really one of the most iconic dishes. I would say much more iconic than paella, which is associated with one region. And, you know, in the surprise about the gazpacho when you encounter it in Spain, that everyone thinks, oh, it's something made with tomato juice.
Right. Yeah.
In fact, the main ingredients, and that couldn't be more Spanish, is leftover bread. Because all over Spain, you have a spectrum of soups, hot and cold, made with leftover bread. And the main ingredients for gazpacho are leftover bread, oil, good olive oil, a little bit of vinegar, and then whatever vegetables you want to add on top of that. Because, of course, before Columbus brought the tomatoes and peppers from the New World, there was no tomato gazpacho. And it is very likely a Roman dish, although they're still debating it. And the word comes from Mozarabic caspa, which means to break into fragments, which is referring to the bread. And bread is what makes it really nourishing and interesting, and what gives it that lovely, lovely texture.
And that's a very old concept. I mean, an ancient concept in the Mediterranean. You never threw away bread. So it's sort of a cross between a bread salad and a bread soup.
It really is that. And, you know, of course, when you blend it all together skillfully, you don't taste the bread, but it adds a texture that you really don't get without it. And, of course, these days, there are so many, you know, interesting deconstructed gazpachos. And from there, I got, you know, great ideas of what to do with it at home. One of my favorite things to do with gazpacho is turn it into sorbet. And what you do is you follow the classic gazpacho recipe, and then you just dump it in the ice cream maker. And don't freeze it too much. It has to be freshly churned. And then you drizzle it with some good olive oil, balsamic vinegar, some, you know, fried bread croutons. The other thing is you can serve
a grown-up sundae. I like this. An adult sundae. This is great.
Oh, you can serve gazpacho in a shot glass with some mint granita or some basil oil. And of course, gazpacho doesn't always involve a tomato. A classic gazpacho from Malaga, which is part of Andalusia, which is a part of Spain that's known for gazpacho, is called ajo blanco, and it is made with almonds, and it's delicious. It's made with almonds, bread, again, olive oil and vinegar, and all kinds of great garnishes you can do for that.
Is this the one that has the grapes in it?
Yeah, classic garnish includes grapes, but for instance, I'm working on a recipe now that has edible flowers, baby lettuces, and figs, fresh figs. So chefs, modern chefs, take the classic idea and then just riff on it every which way. You can add fruit to gazpachos, to classic tomato gazpacho. I love one, for instance, with strawberries and fennel. Or make a gazpacho with sour cherries, beets, and mint granita. And it's all going into my next book on Spain, and I can't wait for you to try the recipes.
Now, essentially, though, all of these begin with that combination of the bread that is soaked with a little water and vinegar and olive oil and, I guess, salt and pepper, right?
Absolutely. Well, salt and pepper you add at the end. Even the most progressive, crazy chefs that just deconstruct, you know, that would deconstruct the table, they still... you know, these are the, like, honored ingredients. Always, always bread. And usually some green pepper and cucumber. And then the vegetables you can vary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, hey, Anya, thank you.
My pleasure.
Anya von Bremsen is author of The Greatest Dishes Around the World in 80 Recipes. Now, you can get Anya's recipe for classic gazpacho on the website, splendidtable.org. That gazpacho raises my two summer issues, peeling and seeding. More good tomatoes and fruit have come to bad ends because of these two things. Now, if the tomato tastes good and the dish isn't affected, leave on the peel, for goodness sakes. And before you seed, you should know that a great-tasting tomato gets that way because it contains about 300 different elements of flavor, and a lot of them are in the gel around the seeds. Peeling fruit's another thing. Dropping fruit in boiling water for 30 seconds to peel it wimps down flavors. And with fruit, and that includes tomatoes, the best taste is either raw or really cooked, and nothing in between. Now, if you have to use heat to loosen skins, roll the fruit over on a hot grill for a few seconds. That dry heat will sweeten it. Now, you can skip the whole heat thing when stone fruits are really ripe. They peel with the nudge of a knife. One buzzword in wine these days is terroir, meaning that the wine should taste of the earth and the place that it comes from. It's the backlash to the international style, where supposedly California tastes like Italy, which tastes like Australia, and so on. Well, it was only a matter of time before the terroir idea spread to other things, like coffee. In the last 5 years, estate coffees have hit the market. Now, one of the people marketing coffee this way is George Howell. His company is actually called Terroir. George, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for having me.
George, we've already got single bean and single estates coffees, right? Now, aren't these expressing this idea of terroir?
Yeah, they can if they're really high quality. Unfortunately, there are very few estates out there. Most firms sell blends. And then after that, say, country of origin and maybe one or two farms specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So how does terroir work?
Terroir really aims at offering single origin, single farm coffees, or single cooperatives when you're talking about really small farmers. And that way, we're really getting down to the fundamentals of the highest possible quality expression that coffee can produce. You can't do that with blends. It's like mixing a wine from Bordeaux, Burgundy, and then a little California mixed in. Hey, mm-hmm. That's a blend, but it's not great.
So is this a way for little-known coffee areas to see more profit?
Yes. It's, in my opinion, it is the only way. The problem for coffee farmers is that 99.999% are totally anonymous. And as of now, there's really no way for them to find buyers who are willing to pay them the price that they deserve. Often they get well below production cost, even if they're producing very high quality.
Now, why is that?
Anonymity. Complete anonymity. They are completely powerless. They have nowhere to go. They have no connections anywhere. So with terroir, we're putting the name out there so that you know whose coffee you're buying. And I think that's critical. We need to give credit where it's due.
So if I'm blindfolded and I'm tasting the different coffees you have, would I really taste a difference?
Yeah, you would. If you're a darker roast drinker, you're going to be at first shocked because these coffees are much brighter. It's a little bit like in the 19th century with wine. Port wine was the drink. Imagine drinking nothing but port wine for 5 years or
pretty
more.
Pretty sweet.
And then suddenly,
yeah.
And heavy, very heavy, and emphasizing body, right, and mm-hmm. thickness. All the things we hear about today. And then drinking a Burgundy and going, oh, my God, this is thin, this is sharp. That's the reaction of a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Others get it right away. But it is at first surprise. Then I hope what they realize is there's a real sweetness here. There's more subtlety, more complexity. And they start to explore layers of flavor and aroma that they've never been through before. And no bitterness at all.
Mm.
Because there's no over-roasting. There's no carbon deposits on your tongue from that darker roast.
No charcoal in your coffee.
Hmm. Correct.
Hey, George, thank you.
My pleasure.
George Howell is president of Terroir Select Coffees. He considers himself a coffee fundamentalist. Well, it's time for the weekly trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. In Turkey 500 years ago, what was the connection between coffee and women's rights? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, in Turkey 500 years ago, what was the connection between coffee and women's rights? Well, back then, a woman could divorce her husband if he did not supply her with her daily quota of coffee. And by the way, she could also own her own property. And that was something that was unheard of in Europe 400 years ago. Anyway, if you've had Turkish coffee, you can understand why being cut off could cause problems. It's inky, it's rich, and it's really fresh tasting, and it's made in a special way. Claudia Roden, in her book of Middle Eastern food, has this wonderful discussion of Turkish coffee and how throughout the area, coffee is the pivot point for business, for contemplation, and for hospitality. Guests are always offered coffee, and it's always made fresh with each arrival. Now, Turkish coffee is made in a small, long-handled pot. And you fresh roast beans, you pulverize them into a powder. And then, according to Roden, for each serving, you need a heaping teaspoon of coffee, sugar to taste, and a small coffee cup of water. Now, these go into that pot. You bring it to a boil. And when you see froth, you remove it from the heat and you stir it once. Now you do the same thing one more time, back on the heat, bring up the froth, let it settle for just a few seconds, and then you pour it very hot into tiny coffee cups with a little froth on top. And then you drink your Turkish coffee. And of course, you never stir it because all the grounds have gone to the bottom.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to those phones. We have got Barbara on the line from Scottsdale. Hey, Barbara, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. Are you guys melting down there?
Almost.
Okay. Okay. what can I do for you?
It's pretty hot. It was 108 yesterday.
Oy.
Well, it's dry, so. I am known in my family as a champion chicken roaster. Everybody loves my roast chicken. But all through the years, I worried about the lower side of the chicken not getting crispy. The breast side gets crispy, but the rest of it doesn't.
You mean the side that you have down?
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So I found a recipe that told me to butterfly the chicken.
Yeah.
And bake it for even an hour or less at 500 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing would be crispy.
It will be.
Yes.
It will be.
But I don't know how to butterfly the chicken.
Ah.
So I was wondering if you could tell me where I could find pictures or illustrations, or maybe you can picture it for me.
Okay.
How to do this.
This is so easy, but I know exactly what you mean. It's like trying to read the directions for setting up my VCR.
Right.
Yeah, I can't do it. I can't do it. Okay, this is what you do. Take your chicken, mm-hmm. okay, your whole chicken,
right.
Put it onto your work board, breast side down.
Right.
Take a sharp knife,
mm-hmm.
all right? Keep your fingers out of the way.
Yes.
Take the knife and put it to, are you right-handed?
Yes.
Okay. Find the backbone. You know where the backbone is.
Yes,
goes right
sure.
down the back of the thing. Okay. Put it just to the right side of the backbone and start sawing. And what you're going to do is you're going to cut through the bones around the neck, and then you're just going to slip right through the ribs. You're going to hit a joint around the hip of the chicken.
So you go
okay.
outside the ribs, right?
You go outside. No. You just cut
inside
right through them.
The ribs.
You're just going to go cut
okay.
right through
right.
that. And what you're going to do is you're going to cut it in half. Now, if you want to be fancy, I mean, you're not going to cut the whole chicken in half. I'm sorry. You're going to cut the back
just
in half.
The back in half.
Right.
Okay.
All the way down. Now, if you want to be fancy, you can remove the entire backbone by doing the same thing on the other side of the backbone.
And
you have a choice. You can do that or not do that. I happen to love to gnaw on the backbone, so I leave it in.
Okay.
But what you then do is take the chicken and you still have it breast down.
Mm-hmm.
Open it up like a book. Just stretch it open.
Right.
Flip it over. Okay?
Yeah.
So the inside of the chicken is now on your board.
Right.
Right? Spread it out. And with the palm of your hand, the heel of your hand, press into that breast area, and you'll hear a little snap, and that's where the bone that makes the breast look like a pyramid snaps, and the breast will more or less flatten out, and you now have a butterfly chicken. It helps it cook a little bit faster.
Yes, it's wonderful. It doesn't take so long to cook, I think.
And my mouth is watering for your roast chicken. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
800 537-5252. We have Inanna on the phone from Portland, Oregon. Hey, Inanna, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, we're about to go camping, and we're going to go fishing, and I'd like a recipe for ceviche.
Ah, you mean raw fish marinated?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Inanna, how old are you? I mean, are you cooking already?
I'm only 11, but I've meant it to be a Father's Day present, but
this is great.
Kinda late.
Well, no, but hey, you can collect Father's Day gifts anytime, right?
Yeah.
Well, let me just explain something. One of the problems with ceviche is that it usually is made with raw fish, and raw fish can be dangerous. You can have some parasites.
I'm not gonna do it alone.
All right, good. But the thing about it is that you'd want to cook the fish first and then do the marinating.
Okay.
Okay? So you can cook the fish any way you like to cook the fish. And then what you're going to do, this you can take with you on your camping trip. You can make it ahead, you know, and put it in a plastic bag or something like that. Okay?
Okay.
You want to take an orange, the juice of one orange, the juice of a lime. Okay.
Okay.
You want a little bit of Worcestershire sauce and a little bit of Dijon mustard.
Okay.
All right. A little bit of olive oil. And what you should do is, as you make this, taste it as you add things. So you see, because you want it to be sort of sweet, sour, okay, with a little kick of hot sauce in there.
Okay.
So then you add to that some hot sauce or Tabasco, whatever you think you're going to like, however much you, to your taste. And salt and pepper to taste.
Okay.
And that's the basics of it. And believe it or not, some recipes, because this comes from South America, have a little ketchup in there. So if you have the juice of a whole lime, the juice of a big orange, let's say you have a teaspoon of mustard, like a dark spicy mustard.
Okay.
And you got a quarter of a teaspoon of Worcestershire. Mm-hmm. And, there's garlic. Got to put garlic. And you've got the hot sauce. You might add like a tablespoon or two of ketchup.
Okay.
Okay? And you can put that in a thing, a jar, whatever, shake it up, and you pour it over the cooked fish. Everybody will be happy, and nobody will have to worry about parasites and stuff like that. And have a great camping trip.
Okay.
Hey, you take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
I love that. I'm not going to do it alone. Great kid. Guys, you can reach us at 800-537-5252. And we've got Heather calling from Seattle. Heather, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
I was calling. My husband and I recently started working opposite shifts. And so we have started to experimenting and freezing lots of things.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you had any tips, suggestions, maybe a book that you knew of, that I could learn more. Like, some things are coming out a little mushy, like we made enchiladas, and, after we threw them in the oven, they're a little bit mushier than I'd like. Just any little tips.
One thing that happens with freezing, whenever there's a lot of moisture in something, that moisture, when you freeze it, becomes ice.
Okay.
It expands. So then, when you defrost, it drains away, and it's broken down some of the cellular structure of whatever that food was. And that's why some things become mushy.
Okay.
You'll notice that the texture of meat might change a little bit in freezing. But the main key with freezing is you don't want air.
Okay.
Okay. And the other thing is you want to freeze as fast as possible. So I am a great fan of those zipper bags, those heavy-duty freezer bags, because I can write on them, I can see what's in them, I can press every single bit of air out of them, and then, I literally just squish the stuff on the counter and then just close the bag.
Yeah, I've even tossed around the idea of getting one of those vacuum sealers.
I don't think you have to spend the money.
No.
Now, all you have to do is just press out the air. See, the other thing is freeze as fast as possible, which means, like, for instance, let's say for argument's sake, you did some grilled chicken and you want to freeze it.
Okay.
I would take the pieces of the chicken, put it on a cookie sheet, stick it in the freezer for an hour and a half, 2 hours. When it's frozen, pull it out, put it in the zipper bag, and put it back in.
Sure.
Okay?
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye. Goodbye. We've got Kira on the line from Eagle River, Wisconsin. Kira?
Thank you for taking my call. Both my brother and I have been listening to you for many years.
Oh, thank you.
We love your show. And I love food.
This is good. This is good. What can I help you with? Got a question?
Yes. I lived in Japan for 2 years, and ironically enough, that's the first time I've ever had cheese fondue, and it was delicious.
In Japan?
Yes, in the land of no dairy products.
Right, right.
The lady who prepared it for me was a Japanese woman, and she made it in my home several times, and it was just awesome, and I fell in love with it. And I remember one of the cheeses was Gruyere.
That's right, yeah.
I can't remember the other cheese, and I think she put some white wine and a little flour, and there wasn't a lot to it, but I have tried to make it here now that I'm back in America, and it's gritty and clumpy. So I would like a good recipe and the correct preparation of cheese fondue.
All right. I think I know what you're doing wrong, and it is the most common mistake. Everybody's made it. There's a little kitchen science that's going to solve all your problems. And it's the easiest thing in the whole world.
Okay.
Well, first of all, generally, it is Gruyere and a good Swiss, which is also known as Emmentaler.
Emmentaler, that was the other one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, she didn't speak English, so they pronounced it in a Japanese way, so I was never sure.
Yeah.
I just knew it would sound like Gruyere, and Emmentaler was the other one.
Right, and a good Gruyere is nutty and delicious, and Emmentaler can be quite similar.
Okay.
Now, you want to take two things you never want to do with cheese. You don't want to get it too hot, and you don't want to cook it too long.
Because then I probably did both.
Well, yeah, but everybody does. It's such a common mistake we make, because what happens is the fat in the cheese separates from the protein, and you get these clumps, and it looks like a salad dressing that's separated. You take a bit of white wine, and you put it in a saucepan, okay? Moderate heat. You bring it to a very gentle simmer. You drop in the cheese. You can add a little cornstarch to that if you want. All right.
What does that do? Does that
well,
help
it just helps. It helps thicken it. It helps thicken it. And the cornstarch, you always mix cornstarch with a little water until it's smooth, and then put it in to whatever recipe you're putting into. And that way, it's not going to clump.
So it's the wine first, then the cheese, and then the watery cornstarch?
That's right. And this would be, just for argument's sake, let's say 1/2 cup of white wine.
Okay.
Equal parts, let's say a total of at most 1/2 pound of cheese. So let's say maybe 3 ounces of Swiss and 5 ounces of Gruyere, just because I like Gruyere better.
Okay.
And that should be shredded. You can do that in the food processor.
Okay.
All right. And then you want maybe 2 teaspoons of cornstarch that you stir into a tablespoon or two of cold water until it's smooth.
Okay.
Not a lot. All right. Now, what you're going to do is you're going to bring that wine to a very gentle simmer. You're going to add the cornstarch to it, stir it around until it thickens a bit, drop in the cheese.
Okay.
And you can stir it with a whisk. All right. But the other thing you're going to do is you're going to add a tablespoon or two of lemon juice, because one of the things that happens when you work with cheese is that the proteins are like hooks. And as they get hot, they hook into each other and tighten up. And if you add acid to that protein, it's going to relax it. It's as though you've got it on a massage table and it's just gone limp. And that's going to smooth out your fondue.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You take care. Bye.
Bye.
Well, there's a new wrinkle on the eating out scene, something that could change that descriptor family restaurant, which usually means bored kids, stressed parents, and mediocre food. Dan Lowenstein has created Playdine in New York City. Dan, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dan, what is Playdine? How does it work?
Well, Playdine is supervised play centers in restaurants. So when a family goes to a restaurant, they eat with their children, but when the children aren't eating, the parents bring them down to a supervised play center where the children can play, and the parents can relax over their meal, over a drink, and over a little conversation.
What an interesting concept. How did you come up with this?
Well, I have two boys. They're four and five right now, and my wife and I always found going out to eat a mixed blessing. You know, it was nice not having to clean up after ourselves, but on the other hand, it was stressful. It was a kind of a race to see, you know, if we can get through a meal without a breakdown or somebody running through the restaurant or, you know, too many spills.
Well, what does it cost parents for this service?
It's $10 for one child admission. We scale it down, $9 for each for two, $8 each for three or more.
Oh, multiples make sense in this case.
Yeah, okay. And that's per party. Uh-huh. And that's for as long as the parents are in the restaurant. We figure no time limit. Parents are already rushing through meals. You know, this is a way for them to relax.
Have you ever had to send a child back?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, some kids just don't adjust well for various reasons. And we have what we do is we take down the parent's cell phone number. Thank God for cell phones. If the child needs their parents or for any reason, we just call the parent in the restaurant and the parent comes down to address that child's needs.
So how many restaurants are you in now?
We're in three restaurants. We're on the Upper East Side, the Upper West Side, and in Greenwich Village.
Any chance of expanding outside New York City? I think there are eager parents wanting to know this.
Yes. I've gotten lots of emails from all around the country and all around the world, actually, asking me to do this. And I do have an expansion plan, and I am talking to various restaurants and other companies about expansion.
You know, Dan, there's another side to this, though. I mean, don't you think this is getting in the way of teaching children to be civilized at the table?
I really don't. I mean, we expect the children in the restaurant to have good table manners. We have rules that say children are not allowed to run through the restaurant. They have to be escorted through. The play area is the only place that the children can play. And the parents are, you know, still responsible for parenting that child and for you know, making sure that child sits at the table politely and eats their meal. But why should a child have to sit through an adult conversation? Why shouldn't a dining out experience be enjoyable for that child as well as enjoyable for the parents, too?
Well, you may be performing a great public service, Dan. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Dan Lowenstein is founder of Playdine. It's based in New York City. Well, guys, that's the show for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Thornton Wilder. He said, "My advice is not to inquire why or whither, but just enjoy your ice cream while it's on your plate." The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Our weeknight kitchen email newsletter is made possible by Organic Valley, an independent cooperative of family farmers bringing fresh milk, juice, butter, eggs, and cream to your local supermarket every day. More information available online at organicvalley.com. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director this week is Nick Kiriakis. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.